Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. Court is pleased to welcome Judge Jefferson to the bench as the approximately the 129th Justice of the Supreme Court of Texas. Justice Heck is not here today, but he will participate in the deliberation and decision of these cases. We have three cases on our oral submission docket this morning. In the order of their presentation, they are First Supermarkets versus Marthana Bethune from El Paso County, Texas Home Management versus Edith Carroll Peavy and O.L. Peavy individually and on behalf of the estate of Elizabeth Ann Peavy from Harris County, and James S. Duty and Paul D. Carrington versus AmeriQuest Mortgage Company, a certified question from the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. In each of these matters, the court has allotted appellant or petitioner 20 minutes to present oral argument and the respondent or appellee 20 minutes. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of our court. We are recording each of these arguments, and you may purchase a tape of any argument for a nominal fee from our clerk. The court is now ready to hear an argument from petitioners, Furs versus Bethune.
May it please the court, Mr. Mark Walker will present an argument for petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. The question before the court in this case is whether a party's emotional state or sympathy for that party's emotional state constitute good cause to prevent a successful party from recovering its court costs against that litigant pursuant to Rule 131.
Mr. Walker, in Rogers versus Walmart, we said that, and I'll quote, in Rule 141 cases, an appellate court should scrutinize the record to determine whether it supports the trial judge's decision. We don't have a record here. How can we then scrutinize the trial court's decision?
Your Honor, the court, I don't think that in Rogers versus Walmart, the court suggested that the record for the entire case is going to be before the court. What we have before the court is the record of the proceedings on the motion to enter judgment. The issue before this case is a legal issue. It's not really a factual issue. We're not here to say that Ms. Bethune did not suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, that she did not suffer from histrionic personality, the other problems.
But without a record, we'd be required to say that in every case, no matter the circumstances, emotional state can never, ever be good cause under the rule.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear
what was. What you're asking us to hold is, as a matter of law, emotional state can never be considered in any circumstances as qualifying under the rule as good cause.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Even if caused by the defendant during the course of the trial.
Well, Your Honor, there's a class of cases concerning the ways that you can deal with conduct of the trial. What we're suggesting is that there would be reasonably objective ways to look at the imposition of costs or to fail to award costs. And those would deal with situations such as in the Rogers versus Walmart case, where there's a question of whether the conduct of the party during the course of the case unnecessarily increased costs. And so what we're suggesting is that's an area where you can reasonably objectively look at the issue and at that point make a determination, well, is it fair in this case? Is there a good cause to permit that successful party to recover all of its court costs because it unnecessarily increased the
so
cost?
So even if during the course of the trial the defendant harasses the plaintiff, even if during the course of the trial and the judge is watching what's going on here and decides that the defense counsel is harassing the plaintiff, the judge could not punish the counsel, even if they win their case, by splitting the cost with the plaintiff.
Judge, we're suggesting that the party's emotional state in general is not a reason that constitutes a good cause to deviate from Rule 131's mandatory.
Well, I'm not articulating very well. Well, yes, I am. You're arguing that even if the defendant harasses the plaintiff during the course of the trial, but it does not increase the cost of the trial, the judge would not have the discretion to punish the defendant by splitting the cost.
We're suggesting, Your Honor, that the party's emotional state, it's very hard to determine what that party's emotional state. The harassment that you're talking about, I think, can be dealt with other ways in terms of the conduct of the course of the trial. That's not our situation here. The issue here is whether that party's emotional state in general constitutes good cause to depart from the Rule 131.
But the way Judge Enoch has phrased the question, he is focusing on the defendant's conduct. And you're saying that costs, if they are not going to be paid to the prevailing party, may be tied to a party's conduct during trial.
We say that the cost may be tied to the trial in terms of the unnecessarily extending the proceedings, making it longer, increasing the cost of the party, and as a result, because of that trial court's determination, in terms of we think that the defendant's conduct, for example, is dilatory, extending the proceedings too long, and that circumstance, it may not be fair for that party to recover all the costs.
But the rule is not so limited on its face. It only talks about good cause.
That's right, Your Honor. But the Rule 141 is, I think, a fairly limited exception to Rule 131. The rule does not speak in terms of a trial court in its discretion may assess costs other than. It says there's got to be some good cause.
But good cause is always a matter of the trial court's discretion, isn't it?
They're within certain parameters.
We are reviewing this decision for abuse of discretion.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Right. So the fact that it says good cause is not sufficient in and of itself to limit the reasons, but the court must, in fact, exercise its discretion to find good cause in order to support a deviation from the normal rule.
That's correct, Your Honor, and the cause must be.
So we're not dealing with an as a matter of law question here. We're dealing with the question of discretion.
Well, but what constitutes good cause, I think, is a matter of law. The issue here is, can the party's emotional state, the fact that the person has a fragile emotional state, whatever the party's sensibilities are, does that constitute good cause? And this court does provide parameters for determining what good cause is. And so, yes, in terms of evaluating the trial court's decision, if the trial court cites a reason that this court does not feel is good cause, then we're talking about an issue that is...
It seems to me I can accept that if you all, or FERS is sued, because they cause emotional distress to the plaintiff. And you get to the end of the trial and the jury says FERS didn't cause emotional distress to the plaintiff. There's a certain symmetry to the argument. Well, if the jury says it didn't cause emotional stress, how dare the trial judge decide there's emotional distress at the end and split costs? There's a certain symmetry to that. The question is that the trial judge is permitted to look at the conduct of the trial, which you can see he can, or she can, and based on their discretion, decide to reassess costs based on what happens during the trial of the case. The argument here is that events happened during the course of the trial. During the course of this hearing, apparently there are some people standing outside the courtroom because there's concern that she might commit suicide. That there's all this reference to stuff that happened during the trial, for which we don't have the record. Is this clear? Is it clear in this record that there's nothing that the defendant did during the course of the trial that caused emotional distress? And if that's if that is not your argument, then I come back to my question, which is, during the course of the trial, couldn't the trial judge have concluded that the way the defendant conducted the trial caused harassment of the plaintiff without any additional cost and still be good cause for splitting the costs?
Judge, if that were his finding, then Rule 141 would require him to state it on the record, which he did not do. In this case, we have to look at the record we have before us is that of the transcript of the hearing.
Well, he didn't state anything on the record for good cause.
He didn't say very much. That's right. And under Rule 141, if he doesn't state a good cause reason on the record, then that's an abuse of discretion. The court should reform the judgment.
Counselor, how long was the trial?
The trial was the better part of a week, almost like 4 days.
Why didn't you bring the complete record of the trial to the Court of Appeals?
Your Honor, we felt it was not necessary because at the hearing on the judgment which the court has before it, the only two reasons that Bethune proffered to avoid the imposition of court costs were, one, just in general the fragile emotional state of the plaintiff. It never made the contention that FERS did anything to cause her condition, that we did anything, a dilatory conduct, harassed her, anything during the course of the trial. That was not a contention at all in the case. The second reason that they gave for trying to avoid the payment of court, the imposition or taxing of court costs, was her financial condition, that she was on disability, and at that point just didn't have any money. So the only two reasons proffered were, one, as a general proposition, she's in a fragile emotional state, not that we did anything during the conduct of the trial to harass her or annoy her, and two, her impecunious financial condition. And we assert that as a matter of law, those two reasons don't constitute.
But you're asking us to assume all of those things to be the case when we don't have a record to review. And if we don't have a record, then we are to presume that what occurred during the proceedings supports what the trial court did. I mean, what you're talking about are lots of things in terms that happened in the trial court, but there was no record in the Court of Appeals, and there's no record here for us to make that determination.
Your Honor, we concede, in terms of the presumption that we talked about under Rule of Trap 34.6, the presumption we're talking about there is, okay, assuming, that we have to assume that there is evidence, as they posited from the psychiatrist about her fragile emotional state, we concede that was her fragile emotional state. But we contend that this is not the factual problem, this is a legal issue.
Well, again,
assuming this to be true, the party's emotional state does not constitute good causes.
Well, again, I want to point you to the language in Walmart that says, unless the record demonstrates an abuse of discretion, which seems to me that it's your burden to bring forth a record that will demonstrate an abuse of discretion. And without a record, the only choice we have is to make a matter of law determination.
Well, Your Honor, I think it was the Justice Ray opinion in the Rogers versus Walmart case, the language came out, but he also said that they reviewed before them the record in the hearing on the motion to enter judgment, and they looked at that record, which caused him to find that, yes, there was evidence to support the trial court's determination. What we say is that we don't want to increase these costs by having their complaint is.
Well, I understand the catch 22 that you don't want to increase the cost of bringing your
record.
But by the same token, our ruling is going to have a very broad sweeping effect, and I presume that it's cost you more to appeal up here than the cost at issue anyway. So to a certain extent, there's a principle involved here, and we're going to be making a broad based rule. And my understanding of our jurisprudence is we have to have a complete record in order to do that. Otherwise, you're asking us to rule as a matter of law in no circumstances ever, even in the circumstance that Judge Enoch proposes, can there ever be a good cause finding that is based upon an emotional state?
Well, Your Honor, I think if we look at Rule 141, we can put this in context, and it'll help us in determining what record is necessary, because under Rule 141, you've got to have a good cause finding on the record. If the trial court doesn't make a good cause finding on the record, then you're not going to have much of a record necessary.
Did you request the trial court to state good cause on the record?
The trial court said what he did. We did not. I didn't feel it was our burden at the time of the hearing to ask him to elucidate any further. He made a statement, and they went on to say that he was going to let each party bear their own court costs. But under Rule 141, if we take a look at what is the issue of dispute, and if the issue of dispute is it an issue that as a matter of law we can say this would not constitute good cause. When we look at what the record is proffered, the hearing, the ideas offered to avoid court costs, do we really need to go look at the entire record of the case?
But the parties referenced the trial at the hearing. The parties recalled to the judge things that happened in the trial. So clearly the judge was basing the decision on proceedings during the trial, and so it's hard for me to try to limit our record to the one hearing on cost, since the trial court obviously was taking into account the entire proceedings.
The trial court was taking into account what the record that we had before us in terms of hearing talks about the party's emotional state in general. In other words, what the psychiatrist testified to, and we don't dispute that, so we do not bring that forward because we don't consider that's in dispute. Agree what the psychiatrist said. We don't feel that record is necessary because, assuming that to be true, her emotional state in general is not good cause. And the trial court did not make any finding. There was no reason offered to say that it was the conduct of the parties, or conduct of the defendant, in this case hers, that caused emotional harm, or was a reason, for example, in the Rogers v. Walmart case, to depart from the general rule. If, in fact, the trial court had indicated, well, we think that you unnecessarily increased costs, then in that case, I think we would be required to bring forth the entire record because we would dispute that. There's a factual dispute. But that's not the case here. We have a fairly limited circumstance.
Well, Mr. Walker, you too. And I'm still troubled, and I'm not sure, and maybe you've answered my question, but you're to get to where you want to go without the record here, do we have to say that irrespective of the conduct of the defendant during the course of the trial, if there is not an actual increase in cost of the litigation, the judge does not have the discretion to split costs?
Your Honor, we're not contending that. That's not the case here. We're looking at the discussion at the hearing and the reasons offered. And those were only, there was nothing there about the conduct of the parties, and the trial court did not make that finding. What we have to look at first is, what is the trial court's ruling? And then work back from there. And here, I mean, reading what he said very liberally, he focused on the emotional state of the party.
In the absence of the trial judge saying the basis for the splitting of the costs, then you say the basis for splitting the cost is limited to what the plaintiff argues at that hearing.
I think that's got to be the point, Your Honor, because otherwise we're left to guess and speculate at the reasons for the trial court, and that's why we have Rule 141, which says that it's got to be good cause, number one. It's got to be legally recognized as a good cause, not any cause, not whatever the trial court thinks, and that reason's got to be stated on the record. If the court finds that the trial court did not state good cause on the record, that's an abuse of discretion by the trial court. It was simply reverse and reform the judgment. What we have to do, though, Your Honor, is take a look at not everything that possibly could have occurred in the trial, but what is the reason? What is the good cause on the record?
Can inability to pay the costs ever be good cause under Rule 141?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
What about all the cases that where in light of fees are assessed against a party who has won in the trial court because the losing party is unable to pay the cost? That has been deemed good cause, so why wouldn't the same principle apply if a party is unable to pay and can show the trial court?
That's really kind of an administration of justice issue, Your Honor, which is kind of a limited circumstance. In terms of the party's pecuniary ability, I think that our law doesn't treat people differently because of their station in life or their ability to pay.
Well, but you do agree, though, that there is a lot of case law in Texas where a losing party has been unable to pay ad litem fees, that the victorious party has been assessed the cost, and that's been upheld on appeal.
That's right. There are cases going both ways on that issue.
All right. So with respect to the question of inability to pay costs, that is an accepted factor under Texas law in some circumstances under Rule 41 as a basis for good cause.
Under very limited circumstances, which are really administration justice issues, to try to make sure that, for example, ad litem gets paid, but that's not this same case here. We're talking about the general proposition of court costs that a party incurs.
Well, I just am trying to make clear, you're talking about a lot of per se rules here this morning, and so if we start talking about per se rules that where we don't have to have a record and we're going to have absolutes, then it seems to me that we've eliminated the trial court's ability to exercise its discretion under Rule 41, which Rule 41 seems to guarantee to the trial court.
There is.
And I want to know how far you're asking us to go, if you're asking us to spill over into the inability to pay cost area as well.
We're talking about non-administration justice cost issues.
Well, no, my question is, are you asking also for a per se rule on inability to pay costs as also being not good cause as a matter of law?
Yes, we are. In terms of these circumstances here, just as
so
a general proposition.
How much discretion does the trial court has very little discretion, and you're pinning in the trial court pretty significantly, aren't you?
We think that the trial court, pursuant to Rules 131 and 141, have very limited discretion because Rule 131 speaks in terms of mandatory language that the successful party shall recover.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court? Mr. Dennis Richard will present argument with respondent.
This case is not about hurt feelings. It's not even about disappointment over losing. What the court was confronted with on September the 3rd, 1999, was Morthana Bethune, a mentally ill lady. Mr. Walker has conceded the fact that she had a problem, and also conceded the fact that her mugging at the first grocery store aggravated that problem. But he stopped short of embracing what Judge Ferguson faced on that day. And that was a 62-year-old woman who was in the courtroom, who her psychiatrist had testified was predisposed to suicidal ideation, who in the courtroom that day burst out that she was threatening suicide. And as she was doing that, just outside the courtroom were two El Paso police officers who had been summoned by a third party to take her into protective custody, which they did as soon as the hearing was
over. Why was your client in the courtroom?
Why was she there?
Why was she there if she was in that mental state?
Well, she came because there was a hearing that had been scheduled.
Why didn't someone stop her or suggest that she not, or reschedule the hearing if she was in that agitated mental state?
No, I didn't know about it that day. All I can tell you is that we showed up for the hearing. She was there, and then the police officers that were had come to just outside the chamber doors.
Did the judge announce the ruling from the bench in her presence?
He did.
Would your argument be different if the judge said, well, I'll take this under advisement and issue a ruling within 30 days?
No. I don't think it would have made a difference for me as for the argument that I'm advancing.
No, well, what you're advancing right now is because of her severe emotional state. At the time the hearing was made, apparently if the judge had ruled against her, she was going to commit suicide on the spot. My question is, if the judge took it under advisement, she went home, she calmed down over a period of several weeks, and the judge did what judges typically do, and that is just issue an order several weeks later. She may not have even known about it until you told her about it later.
Well, I would submit to you that the problem that we have in this case is that Rule 34.6C was not complied with by FIRST, and as a result, we don't have the record, which would include other reasons why the judge would have decided the way he did.
But can we look at those other reasons? Man, Rule 141 says the judge has to state good cause on the record. And doesn't that limit us to whatever the... Isn't our total universe of what we look at the words the judge used?
Here's what Judge Ferguson used. He said, I am not going to be the one to precipitate any further emotional problems for her. That could include emotional problems that had been precipitated during the course of that trial, so that the court could be considering, as part of its basis of good cause, the conduct of FIRST and their counsel during a one-week trial.
Do you know, are there any cases that reimpose costs because of conduct apart from conduct that increases expense to the losing party?
I can't cite you to a case at this moment. All I would want to do is to
Did you make any kind of allegation ever that FIRST conduct during the trial created your client's mental or emotional state?
I believe FIRST conduct during the trial had a lot to do with her emotional state.
Did you argue that to the judge or put that in your pleadings and say that's a reason that you should award costs or assess costs against FIRST and not your client?
I don't know that I argued it at the hearing. I basically pointed out to the court things that were testified to during the trial, the fact that she was 100% disabled because of a stress disorder.
None of that had to do with FIRST.
Well, it had, I think, the fact that she was mugged outside FIRST, and also...
But it had nothing to do with FIRST conduct or FIRST counsel's conduct during the trial.
Well, during the trial, Your Honor, the judge had an opportunity to observe Morthana Bethune in the courtroom. To observe Mr. Walker trying the case, the questioning of Morthana Bethune, all things that were not brought forward in the record.
But can we look at those in considering the trial judge's discretion if they're not part of the reasons stated on the record?
Well, I believe this court has stated that a Rule 141 case is the appellate court should scrutinize the record to determine whether it supports the trial judge's decision to tax the successful party with part or all of the court costs.
Okay, but that's ambiguous. Are we limited to the reason the trial judge gave, or can we look at the entire record to see if the decision the trial judge made could be supported for any reason?
I believe that whenever a a limited record is brought forward, as it was in this case, and the defendant, or FERS in this case, failed to comply with the appellate court's rule?
But that's apples and oranges. So what you're saying is if the trial judge gives a reason and there's a whole record, then we can only look at that reason. If the trial judge gives a reason and there's not a whole record, we can look at any reason, whether the trial judge stated it or not?
First of all, the reason that I believe that Judge Ferguson gave included things that happened during the trial. And because they did not bring forward a complete record, this court can't look at those things.
Counselor, you benefited from the court's ruling. Is that correct? The court split costs even though your client did not prevail. Right?
My client would have benefited, yes.
Exactly. Now, why did you not then, in accordance with Rule 141, submit to the court for the court's signature an order that stated good cause for his ruling? Why wasn't that your burden to do that?
I believe at the hearing, one of the things that Judge Ferguson asked me to do was, first of all, the hearing started without a court reporter. And then a court reporter was summoned, and then things were restated that had been talked about while the court reporter was not there. And I tried to summarize at that time things that did take place.
Did you have an obligation to submit to the court or to request from the court an order that stated good cause for his ruling?
I believe that the things that I recited in that hearing that are part of the record do establish
what you recited. The things of good cause, or isn't it the court that has to make a finding of good cause on the record?
Well, the court made a finding that I indicated a moment ago about the fact that he would not be one to precipitate any further emotional problems for Marfan of Bethune, and he split the cost the way he did. But the things that I was reciting were things that were, he observed the police officers that were just standing outside the courtroom. He heard the outburst from Marfana Bethune threatening suicide. He had heard the testimony that Marfana Bethune was predisposed to suicide. All of this was part of both the trial and what happened in that hearing.
Well, it strikes me that your opposing counsel is asking us to draw some bright line rules. It seems that the court stated cause, and it's our question to determine whether that's good cause. And what do we have to look at to determine, to make that assessment of good cause? You say, and I believe we've said before, case-by-case basis, need to look at the record. But as I understand your opposing counsel, they're saying that if we were to, that we should enact a rule that says emotional state can never, as a matter of law, be good cause, else someone will come in and say, I'll kill myself if you award costs against me. And what do you have to say in response to that argument?
Well, I would respond to this. The difference with Marfana Bethune was that we had a psychiatrist who had testified that she was predisposed to suicide. We had an outburst of suicide in the courtroom. We had police officers waiting to take her into protective custody. A lot different than an individual who loses a case and then says, well, I'm distraught because I lost the case. There had been testimony about her fragile emotional state. These are all factors, I believe, that Judge Ferguson had a right to take into consideration.
Well, where do you draw the line? If we rule in your favor in this case, what if in the next case all that happens is you have a psychiatrist who testifies that the person is going to commit suicide if costs are taxed against that party, but you don't have the police officers outside? Is that going to be good enough the next time?
Well, I think what you do is you depend upon the trial court judges that are out there and make discretionary rulings every day.
Well, that's the point, and that is that you would have a situation where any sufficiently emotional losing litigant who is capable of playing upon the heartstrings of the judge is going to be able to prevail and say that even though I lost, cause should be taxed against the winning party. And of course, the bigger the case, the more you're going to have people come in and say, golly gee, this person is going to really break down, and we're going to bring here a police officer just to build up our case to make it more like the first case.
You know, I would respond to that the test is an abuse of discretion test, and this court has made the decision that that's whether the court acted in arbitrarily, unreasonably, or without reference to any guiding principle. I believe that Judge Ferguson acted in a reasonable manner.
What are the guiding principles here?
For Judge Ferguson?
Yes.
a one-week trial, watching Marthana Bethune, listening to her testimony, listening to the testimony of a psychiatrist, observing her outburst of threat of suicide, observing the two police officers that were standing just outside the courtroom that took her into protective custody. Those are the things.
So what that means, again, is in the future, in all future cases that are litigated in the state of Texas, judges, whenever there is a situation where you have a psychiatrist testify that a person is subject to suicide, that person is going to be able to evade having cost of court taxed against them. If those are the guiding principles.
I still believe that it's a trial court that looks at it and makes the decision. It's a discretionary decision.
What if this had been a three-month trial? And so the record would be prohibitively, well, it wouldn't be prohibitively, it'd be very expensive. You would still say that in order to have a review of the trial judge's ruling, a party who has only that complaint, that costs have been taxed a long way, would have to have that entire record prepared, or else we'd have to presume that somewhere within that 3 months there was a factor that would support that exercise of discretion.
Now, Judge, all that Mr. Walker had to do was comply with the rule, and the rule says that he must include a statement of the points or issues to be presented on appeal. He did not do that. Because he did not do that, then he does not get the presumption that the rest of the record is irrelevant. We get, rather, the presumption that it is all relevant and that it supports the judgment of the trial court. And that's why we have taken the position that his mistake about not bringing forward the record or at least complying with that rule is fatal to this appeal.
But Mr. Walker argues, though, that in the notice of appeal, he notices that the issue he wants to raise is the trial court's assessment of costs, doesn't he?
He makes reference to that, but there's case law that has addressed just such a general statement like the one that Mr. Walker used in his notice of appeal, seeking only to appeal Judge Ferguson's failure to award costs pursuant to Rule 131 is insufficient to satisfy Rule 34.6C, and that's Quick Wash Laundries versus McIntyre, 840 Southwest.
So what should he have said to limit his appeal?
All he had to do was say with particularity what the issues were. I guess the issue about emotional state, he needed to specify.
So just the general objection that he split costs was not sufficient to raise the issue of whether or not the good cause was sufficient.
Exactly. More recent case, the general description of the proposed intentions of error is insufficient. That's Gardner versus Baker and Botts. That's 6 Southwest 3rd, 295.
And is the purpose of those holdings to then require a request of just those portions of the record that would deal with that particular piece?
Exactly, and it would be my burden. Once he would specify what they are, it would be my burden.
That portion of the record.
That portion of the record that I believe should be in there. By not doing that, then he falls prey to the presumption that I talked about a moment ago.
In working at drawing this bright line, let's go back to the facts you claim support the trial court's discretion. Which of the facts that were presented would you find would be necessary to eliminate in order to say that the trial court abused its discretion? If you eliminated the police officers, would the trial court have abused its discretion? If you eliminated the psychiatrist's testimony, would the trial court have abused its discretion? Which facts would you eliminate in order to show, as a matter of law, the trial court abused its discretion?
All I can respond to that again is to say that what this court has set forth as the standard for an abuse of discretion is, did he act arbitrary?
Well, let me ask you. Well, if that's the case, I mean, let's assume you had a half-day trial with no emotional losing party. The losing party seemed to be a happy individual. And the trial court awarded costs against the prevailing party. Would that be an abuse of discretion?
Can't answer that.
So you're saying it's always just going to be, we're always going to have to rubber stamp whatever the trial court says?
No, not at all. Not at all.
Then help me. So you're saying a trial court can't abuse its discretion?
Yes, I think I believe a trial court can abuse its discretion.
Well, then help me understand which facts would have to be eliminated in this case to show the trial court abused its discretion?
I can't believe that you can take and set what you're trying to do is a bright line test. I think it has to be that the trial court, based upon the trial court's observations and the evidence that came forth, and that's what we get back to, is the fact that there is no record, then you don't have an opportunity to look over the trial court's shoulder and decide whether or not he's abused his discretion. The problem that they have and should have, because of the rule, is that you now, and the case law has said, this court, meaning the Supreme Court, must presume that the omitted portions of the record are relevant to this appeal and that the missing evidence supports the trial court's judgment. So we don't have to, I guess what I'm saying is, although I do believe that Judge Ferguson had good cause, and I believe that there was enough stated, despite that, the fact that they didn't bring forward a full and complete record or comply with the rule as they should have, they then must live with what they've done. And this court, according to the case law, is to presume that there, that the omitted evidence would have supported Judge Ferguson's decision.
What if his reason was patently erroneous? He adjudged cause as he did because of the ethnic background of the litigants or something. Then would this rule still apply? And we would need to presume that there was some good cause within the rest of the record?
I can't address whether, I really don't know as far as that's concerned, but we don't have that situation in this case.
Well, your opposing counsel says you do. They say the reason the judge gave on its face, that is, that he's not going to be the cause of any further problems she had, is an invalid reason, the same as if he said, I'm readdressing cause because the party is of a certain racial background. And so that's my question to you. I just want to isolate it.
And
the reason on its face is so bad that nobody could argue it, would you still have your presumption and need to look at the rest of the record?
The reason that the judge gave is a reason that could include the conduct of FERS during the trial of the case.
Well, but that's, my question is, what if the reason was just awful? Terrible.
That was the only reason that was given.
That's the reason he gave. Would we need to look at the rest of the record?
May not.
Counselor, I'm going to ask you to, since we don't have the record, and you referred to the conduct of FERS during the trial of the case in oral argument here, just ask you to tell us, what conduct are you referring to? I mean, is that really an issue, or is that just a presumption that you're asking us to make?
Well, it's a presumption that I believe that the court is required to make because of the case law and the rule.
Now, was there conduct of FERS during the trial of this case that you think would permit the court to assess costs differently than under Rule 131?
I believe there was.
What was it?
I mean, I'm way outside the record.
Cross-examination?
Well, it'd be cross-examination. It'd be the rules.
The cross-examination was too aggressive, for example. Is that what you're saying?
I mean, again, as an advocate, yeah, I would take the position it was too aggressive. I would take the position that FERS had written rules about how they were supposed to have security at their stores.
I'm not talking about the underlying facts there. I'm talking about the conduct. Were there any sanctions? Do we have any orders of sanctions against counsel for FERS for their conduct?
No, there were not any sanctions.
Were there motions for sanctions that we can review that you prepared based on conduct of defense counsel?
No.
Do you believe the trial judge can consider the facts that are submitted to the jury assessing costs? In other words, the defendant did something that caused the accident. The jury found they didn't, but the trial judge could say, I think the jury may have been wrong. I can't reverse their verdict, and I don't want to try this thing again, but I'll just fiddle with the costs, make it come out a little fairer.
No, I don't believe that the court should be doing that.
So if that's the case, then we can't really consider anything about FERS, their books on what they should have done or should not have done in terms of security, et cetera. I mean, that was the jury's problem.
I believe that was the jury's problem.
Any other questions?
Yes, Mr. Richard, Mr. Walker argues that if we find the court's statement of good cause insufficient, regardless of what the record may or may not show, if we find the trial judge's statement of good cause insufficient, he says that results in a reforming the judgment. Do you have any authority out there that would argue that it ought to be remanded to the trial court for reconsideration of the assessment of costs? Or do you agree with Mr. Walker that if the statement of good cause is insufficient, then it simply is a rendition of all costs against the plaintiff?
I don't have a case to give you, Judge, but I would believe that if that were the decision that the court made, that it ought to go back to the trial court to give the trial court an opportunity to state it more specifically.
My other question is the trial judge, you have one statement in the record from the trial judge on what he's going to do, and it says he was not going to precipitate further emotional problems. Irrespective of what the record shows, is it good cause for the judge to say that I won't assess costs because I will emotionally harm the plaintiff by doing so? Would that be a good cause basis for a trial judge to reassess costs because the trial judge thought that he would cause emotional distress?
I believe that if a statement by the judge that having heard the entire trial and observed the things that took place in the hearing, then is making the decision about how he's going to handle costs, that that's part of the discretion that he has if he states it for good cause.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Mr. Steve Hughes will present the rebuttal for the petitioner.
May it please the court. Interestingly, it was the first legislature of the state of Texas in 1846 that passed a statute that said the successful party should get its costs. The good cause exception was passed in 1879. And since that time, the courts have essentially looked at three different categories for avoiding the payment of costs to the successful party. That is, whether the party completely prevailed, in the administration of justice to get court-appointed personnel such as Ed Idles paid, and the Rogers versus Walmart situation, in which the defendant has unnecessarily extended the proceedings. And I think what the courts have implicitly recognized is that for good cause, you've got to have a darn good reason, and that reason must bear on what happened at the trial, how the case was tried, and the case's outcome. And I think what the courts have avoided, although not explicitly, is that the courts have not looked at extraneous results of their rulings, or matters such as a party's situation in life, or the party's emotional state, or the effect of their judgment on that emotional state.
Does FERS in any way contest that this plaintiff had very significant problems?
No.
Do you in any way contest that this is a very extreme set of facts as opposed to the scenario that someone mentioned earlier that someone was just upset because they lost their case? And in fact, we are really dealing with a very significant problem here. Does FERS in any way dispute that?
No, Your Honor. We could see that she did have significant problems.
This woman had very significant problems and she was in danger.
That's right. Our contention is okay. the extraneous effect or the effect of imposing costs should not be a relevant factor.
You all don't doubt that she was in danger either?
At the moment, we do not doubt that at the hearing that she had made statements to the effect that
you
she
don't,
could
but,
harm
But
herself.
Having heard the psychiatrist at trial and having seen her conduct and everything, you all had no reason to question that this was very real.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I think, Your Honor, where the court had discretion, as has been pointed out before, was the timing of entering judgment. There was no reason the judge had to enter judgment at that time. He could have called a recess. He did not necessarily have to have the parties there or the lawyers there when he signed the judgment. And that's where the court's discretion lay in this case, but not in refusing tax costs.
The trial judge just get one shot at giving these reasons under Rule 141?
I believe so, Your Honor, because it says that the trial judge must state on the record his reasons.
Are there other places in the rule that are this restrictive? And by that, I mean the trial judge gives a statement. It doesn't have to be in the order.
offhand language. And then that's it. That limits what we can look at, and the trial judge never gets another bite at the apple.
That's what the lower courts have done almost exclusively is they have looked at the record, looked at the statement of good cause. If it wasn't there or if it's insufficient, they have reformed the judgment.
But are there other places in the rules, not other cases on this rule, are there other places in the rules with a similar scheme?
I can't think of any, Your Honor.
I'm just sitting here trying to think.
It is unusual that there has to be a statement of good cause, and I think that's what affects the record issue in this case, is that we can't go rumbling through and presume that the record showed anything other than the statement that the judge gave, and that's the universe.
Can you conceive of any scenario at all in which the emotional status of the plaintiff could affect the award of cause, could be good cause?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because I think the judge can handle that through his discretion in entering judgment.
Well, let's take, for example, a situation. Now, I'm not saying that happened here, and I haven't heard anyone indicate that it did. But let's presume that during the trial, Walmart's counsel unnecessarily harassed the plaintiff on the witness stand, berated her, brought up embarrassing things in her past, and it caused her a complete breakdown. In your estimation, could that ever constitute a basis for good cause if that happened?
Your Honor, I don't believe so, and I say it because we believe that if you look at the cases, the good cause exception has been very narrowly construed by the courts in certain situations.
Well,
and there are other methods that could be utilized by the trial court.
Well, you say it's been narrowly construed. That means we have found in certain cases that good cause existed. That doesn't mean that we have said they never, ever can under any other circumstance. It's just there have been certain situations where we have recognized it. So under my scenario where they subject the plaintiff to withering cross-examination that's improper and causes her to have a nervous breakdown, even
through his discretion in entering judgment.
Well, let's take, for example, a situation. Now, I'm not saying that happened here, and I haven't heard anyone indicate that it did. But let's presume that during the trial, Walmart's counsel unnecessarily harassed the plaintiff on the witness stand, berated her, brought up embarrassing things in her past, and it caused her a complete breakdown. In your estimation, could that ever constitute a basis for good cause if that happened?
Your Honor, I don't believe so, and I say it because we believe that if you look at the cases, the good cause exception has been very narrowly construed by the courts in certain situations.
Well,
and there are other methods that could be utilized by the trial court.
Well, you say it's been narrowly construed. That means we have found in certain cases that good cause existed. That doesn't mean that we have said they never, ever can under any other circumstance. It's just there have been certain situations where we have recognized it. So under my scenario where they subject the plaintiff to withering cross-examination that's improper and causes her to have a nervous breakdown, even then you would say costs cannot be awarded against Walmart.
I believe that would not be the right avenue, Your Honor. I think in the course of discretion would lie in limiting the cross-examination or making sanctions at trial against the party or the attorney.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument on the first cause, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.